Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question: "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" So here's where we are. Jesus is a 33-year-old construction worker who's traded in his hammers and chisels and saws to go into the ministry. And within a couple years, he is the most famous and most controversial public figure in the world. Think Joe Rogan. Ordinary people love Jesus. People in positions of power hate Jesus. So much so that a couple days before this, the people gave Jesus a ticker tape parade as he entered the capital city. So much so that a couple days after this, the leaders are going to staple his body to a tree. But here on Jesus's last Tuesday out in public, the establishment is trying to trip him up. They're asking Jesus tough questions, trick questions, no-win questions so that Jesus will hang himself. But he doesn't. He never does. He answers each question with way smarter answers than they thought were possible. In fact, each question answered just makes Jesus look that much better at doing life than all of them who are asking the questions. So eventually, they all stop asking questions because they're only helping his case every time they ask a question. Except one guy. One professor, one guy can't help but ask Jesus one more question. Even though he knows he's losing, maybe because he knows he's losing, this guy tries one more time. And he hits Jesus with the one question that he knows Jesus will not be able to answer because it's too tricky to even answer. It's not tricky like the question, what starts with W and ends with T? And the answer is, yes, it does. What starts with W and ends with T? Yes, it does. It's not tricky like the question, what's bigger than God, more evil than the devil, the poor have it, the rich need it, and if you eat it, you'll die. And the answer is nothing. Nothing is bigger than God, nothing is more evil than the devil, the poor have nothing, the rich need nothing, and if you eat nothing, you'll die. Not tricky like that. This question that this guy asked Jesus is a real question. But he is sure that there is no good answer. How could there be an answer? How could you answer this question? What is the greatest command in God's law? There are so many commands. Whichever command Jesus picks, he's going to leave out a lot. And the professor knows that that will leave Jesus vulnerable to criticism. Because they'll say, oh, Jesus, you say don't make graven images to bow down to is the most important. So as long as I don't have idols in my house, it doesn't matter how I treat my parents, huh? Oh, Jesus, you say don't murder is the greatest commandment? So as long as I don't murder, it's okay if I work myself to death 7 days a week as long as I can stand it. Is that what you're saying? Oh, Jesus, you say don't say things that aren't true about other people is the most important commandment? So as long as I don't lie, I'm free to lie in bed with anyone I choose? Is that what you're saying, Jesus? Do you see no matter which command Jesus chooses, he's going to look bad on all the ones that he doesn't choose? At least that's what this Pharisee who was asking the question thought would happen. He hoped that would happen. So he says, Jesus, what do you got? Which command is the greatest of all God's commands? And I wonder, don't you wonder this sometimes? When you read something in the Bible, don't you wonder just how the person said what they said? We're often reading along in Scripture and we know what the person says, but we don't know how they said it. Like back in Isaiah 6, when Isaiah gets to visit heaven, and he realizes he has no right to be there, but an angel brings a burning coal over and touches his mouth, which purifies him to speak. And then God says, wow, I've got this message I really need people to hear. Who will go speak for me? And the words that Isaiah says next are, here am I, send me. But don't you wonder how Isaiah said it? Like at that point, did Isaiah say it like he was eager, like, here I am, send me, send me? Or did he say, was he fearful of how it might turn out if he went to deliver God's message? Did he say, here I am, send me? Or was he reluctant? Was he resigned? Did he know he was going to have to do this? Here I am, God, send me. Or was he looking around heaven when nobody spoke up? Was Isaiah hopeful to be the one chosen? Did he say, here am I, send me? We know the words that he spoke, but there are no notes about his tone of voice, and we wish we knew. How about the time when Jesus and Peter were talking, walking on the beach? Jesus asked Peter if Peter loved him, and Peter said, you know I do. And then Jesus asked Peter if he loved him, and Peter said, "You know I do." And then Jesus asked Peter if Peter loved him, and the words Peter then said were, "Lord, you know all things. You know I love you." But haven't you always wondered how Peter said those words after that third question? Did he say it with heart-wrenching regret for having denied Jesus, being Jesus' friend three times and realizing that's what Jesus was asking? Or did he say it with a hope-filled longing for Jesus to just forgive Peter for what he'd done? Or did he say it knowing that he was loved by the most gracious man he'd ever met? And did he have amazing feelings of safety and security when he said it? We don't know how Peter, it doesn't say how he said it, just says what he said. I wish we had the tape. So here we know what Jesus says. We have Jesus' answer to this question, but I so wish we had more. When the professor asked Jesus, "So Jesus, what's the greatest command, huh? What do you think?" Did Jesus fire back his answer? Did Jesus ring in before the professor even finished reading the question? Or did Jesus stop to think for a moment? Did he rub his beard? Did he choose from many possible answers? Or maybe Jesus just looked at the man for a long time, really sad because the guy didn't even really want an answer. I wish we knew. But apparently that's not the important part, because God doesn't choose to include that. What God did think valuable to include is that when Jesus is challenged to name the one most important thing, he said, I was playing pickleball with some friends one morning this week, and one of them asked me in between games, "So what you got going on for the rest of the day, Walker?" And I said, "Shoveling." So that narrows down the day of the week this occurred to any. And then I said, "No, today I'm going to try to write something interesting and helpful for our church." And one lady standing there looked at me and she said, "Good luck with that." And I wasn't sure if she doubted that I could be interesting or that I could be helpful. She's never heard me preach, so she might have meant both. You have heard me preach, so you know my best hope is to be helpful. But this month's sermon series is called "Who Do You Love?" And I think that this month I can be both, but especially helpful. Like this: do you know what's the most important thing you can do with your life? Do you know the thing that's going to make you or break you, the one thing, the most important thing, the one thing that you have to do in life? Do you know what your one thing in life is? I know mine. I know my one thing. In fact, I know your one thing. I know the one thing that will define your life, as good or bad, as meaningful or wasted, as successful or not. I know your thing. And if you will make this your thing, you will win. You can win at life. This is the secret, because when Jesus was quizzed on what is the most important thing, he told us what that thing is. He quotes from Deuteronomy 6, and Jesus replied when asked that question. He said, the one most important thing? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And before the professor could follow up with a question about all the other commandments in the Bible, Jesus says, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. So what's the most important thing in life? Not being happy, not being healthy, not being wealthy, not being known, not finding yourself, not living up to your potential, not leaving a legacy, not being nice to other people, not even feeling loved. None of those normal things is the most important. None of the things that usually get mentioned in graduation speeches or usually listed in eulogies, none of those things. When asked what was the most important thing, Jesus said, love God with everything you've got. Love him like nobody's business. And in an attempt to be really helpful, let's think about what that looks like. First of all, to love God, which Jesus says is the one thing that really matters for you, you got to decide if God is real or not. I heard an atheist challenged recently. Somebody said to him, how can you not believe in God? And the atheist said, which one? And the person challenging him said, what do you mean, which one? And the atheist said, which God can you not believe that I don't believe in? Zeus, Ra, Ganesh? And the person said, no, not those, the real one, the one in the Bible. And the atheist said, oh, Jehovah. Well, you know how you don't believe in all those other ones I mentioned? That's how I don't believe in yours. And when I heard him say that, I thought, ah, it's a good point. Kind of like when I read Paradise Lost. Do you remember Paradise Lost, famous book by John Milton? When Satan was explaining to the other angels in that story about how Jehovah isn't really God. He's just another angel like they are, but he got here first. And when he looked around and everything was there, and then other angels started showing up, God claimed that he made everything and he should be number one. And Satan goes on to say how Jehovah's actually just an egomaniacal, narcissistic angel like them, but he lies. And when I read that for the first time, I thought, huh, how do I know that that's not true? That could be true. God could have just been here first saying that he made everything, even though he didn't. And that bothered me for several days. But when I got to the end of all that wondering that I did, it came down to this for me. Jehovah God says one thing about origins. The evil one says something different. Jehovah God says a certain thing about how we should live. The evil one offers us other options. Jehovah says, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. The evil one said, Jesus should die. And in my experience, what Jehovah God says proves true. And the evil one's ideas always fall apart. When I live my life based on what Jehovah says is real, it works. When I don't live his way, it doesn't work. And that's not just my testimony. That has been the testimony of many people all over the world throughout time. For as long as there have been people who do life with Jehovah have found him to be good. So I choose, based on the evidence I have and the experiences I've experienced, I choose to bet that God is telling the truth and Milton's lost paradise. Same with the other gods, Ra, Ganesh, Zeus, Thor, Allah. Those are interesting stories, but they do not lead to a life worth living now, and they do not provide evidence of a better life yet to come. So the first part of loving God is you got to decide, based on the evidence that you have in front of you, if he's really there, if he's really real. That's where love for God begins. It's like the author of Hebrews said on page 11 of his sermon. He said, by faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. And then he goes on to say, now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance of what we don't see. And without faith, it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. And the Hebrew author says, this is what the ancients were commended for, that they believed God existed and that he rewarded those who earnestly sought him. To love God with everything in you, first you need to be confident that he's really there. And then, like learning to love anybody that you love, you got to get to know him better. After you acknowledge that he's there, you got to know him. It's kind of hard to love somebody you don't know, right? Like, if I were to ask, show of hands here today, who here loves Jimmy Sanchez? Raise your hand. I see some hands, yes. A few of you. And probably a couple of you out there watching the live stream. I see those hands too. But many of you, most of you, do not raise your hands. Why do you not raise your hands? You say, that's easy, Walker. I don't know Jimmy Sanchez. How could I love him? In order to love someone, you have to get to know the person. What are they like? What do they like? How do they think? How do they act? What do they love? What do they hate? What do they hope? How can they help? Those of us who love Jimmy have spent time with him. We've talked with him. We've eaten with him. We've studied the Bible with him. We've prayed with him. We've played with him. We've watched him hit home runs so far over outfielders' heads. It's silly. We love Jimmy because we've done life together with him and we have found him good. Same way you make lifelong friends. You cross each other's path somehow. You share some common interests. You connect. You spend time together. You do stuff with each other. You start doing stuff for each other. Eventually, you're good friends. Same with falling in love with someone. There is a formula to it, right? I saw a meme this week. It said, what has 15 actors, 4 settings, 2 writers, and 1 plot? 136 Hallmark movies. A big city career woman, too busy for love, has to move to a small town, meets a handsome local bachelor who, in spite of some major obstacles, teaches her the true meaning of Christmas, and it starts to snow and they kiss. There's also a dog. That's just the way people fall in love on Hallmark every time. I saw another meme. It said, clairvoyant husband amazes wife by accurately predicting the ending of every Hallmark movie. But it's kind of true. You don't fall in love with someone you have no dealings with. In order to love somebody, you have to do life with them. Same with loving God. Loving God is not something religious. Loving God is something relational. So, if this is the biggest thing, if loving God is the most important thing in life, then we need to do the things that help that relationship happen. Like get to know him better. How do you do that? How do you get to know God better? Same as you would get to know anyone that you're thinking about befriending. You talk with him. You ask him questions. You listen for his answers. You watch how he acts. Jesus said, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be open to you. For everyone who asks receives, the one who seeks finds, and to the one who knocks, the door will be opened. Jesus says, which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? Ask, talk with God, see what he does in different situations in your life, see what he's like. Read the stories of what he's done in the past. That'll tell you a lot, right? Knowing what he's done already matters. Some of us love the This Is Us family. And the more we know the backstories, the more we love them. Some of us love God, and what he's done for his family over the years is part of why we love him. Do stuff with him. Do stuff for him. Follow his lead. See where that takes you. Give God the benefit of the doubt when something goes sideways in life, but ask him about it and talk to other people who know him. Listen to what they say about him and their relationship. See if God is a good influence on them. See how they live. See what they do. Did you hear about the Episcopalian priest, Father Ralph, who was visiting his wife in the hospital before she was having surgery? He went in that day wearing his collar. He was talking with his wife for a while, and he prayed with her. And then before he left the room, he leaned down, and he kissed her passionately. And then he left. The nurse, who had been standing in the hallway and saw all that, walked in and said, wow, I have been a member of my church for a long time, but our minister sure doesn't treat us like yours does. If you want to get to know God, then get to know the people who know God. That will help you. The songwriter, Psalm 9, number 34, talks about how life can be really bad. Like, sometimes it's really bad, but those who love God will always somehow end up okay, no matter how bad it gets. In Psalm 34, 8, it says, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. Fear the Lord, you his holy people, for those who fear him lack nothing. So involve yourself with God. Invite God to be part of your life. Check him out. See if a friendship starts to grow. That's what you do in the beginning with people you end up loving every time. So Jesus says the most important thing you can ever do, ever, is to love God big. And to do that, you have to come to a place where you figure out that he's really there, and you have to engage him to find out what kind of person he really is. But to love God, to love anybody, is more than just that. Love is more than meeting someone and getting to know them. Love is when you decide that you are going to commit yourself to doing what is best for the other person. That's what love is, deciding that you are going to sacrifice your life for the good of other persons, to do what's good for them. If you love your spouse, you do what's best for your spouse. If you don't do what's best for your spouse, you don't love your spouse. Whatever it costs you, you listen to her, you cheer for him, you support them, you challenge them, you give up what you want to do, what they need you to do. That's what love is. You arrange your life to help the person that you love become the very best person they can be, whatever that costs you. If you love your kids, same. You do what's best for your kids, whatever they need doing. And sometimes they will love that you love them, and sometimes they won't love that you love them, but you do what's best for them no matter what. That's what you do because that's what they need you to do. Same with God. If you love God, you do what's good for him over what's good for you. You pick him. Now, the funny part is, doing what's best for God always turns out to be best for you. But it doesn't always seem that way. For instance, do you remember when Jesus was in the garden, night of his arrest, Gethsemane? He was saying, I'm not really feeling this whole death by crucifixion thing. So I know that's the plan, and I know, Father, you think that's going to lead to good, and I love you, but if there's any other possible way we could do this, I would vote for that. But again, I will do what's good for you. So if you think this is the best, if that's the deal, I'm in. He said that because that's what his father needed. So Jesus was all in because he loved his father. Are you all in? Do you love God? Do you love God enough to do what's good for him, even if it costs you? Do you remember that famous line from Jesus when he said, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also? And it means that wherever you choose to put your treasure, that's what you love. That's where your heart will be, wherever you store your treasure. And most people hear that verse and they think Jesus is talking about money, but not really. Not really, because people can treasure money. A lot of people do. But you know what people treasure even more than money? You know what people treasure the most? Themselves. Because that's the one thing that we have more than anything else. What we have is ourself. And where we choose to put that, whatever or whomever we give ourselves to, that's where our hearts are, Jesus says. That's what matters to us. That's who we love. Some people love football teams. They know the players' names. They know they go to all the games. They buy all the merch. It's kind of like their church. Do you remember that game? People were out in the stadium covered with snow, and they still sat there and cheered for our team because they love the Bills. But Jesus says, if you want to win in life, love God first, most, love him, which requires you to acknowledge him, to interact with him, and then choose at some point to do what's best for him. And what's best for him is that you give yourself to him. Like the song says, I'm yours, Lord, everything I've got, everything I am, everything I'm not, I'm yours, Lord. Try me now and see if I can be completely yours. And when you love someone, when you decide to do what's best for another person, it always makes your life better. Loving is amazing like that. But when God is the one you love, that makes life as good as it can be. For example, do you remember the story about Tom Schmidt? A Christian man who went to visit in a nursing home regularly. And one Mother's Day, he was walking down a hallway that he didn't usually go down, where sat the worst cases of people who were not mentally there, who could not control their bodies at all. Tom Schmidt had brought flowers with him that day, and he had one left. And when he saw the woman who looked worst of all in that hallway, he could tell by her blank stare that she was blind, by her thick hearing aid in her ear, by the cancer eating away the side of her face, left her deformed, her mouth was drooping, she was drooling. He said she was repulsive looking. That's what it was. But Tom Schmidt walked up to her and stuck a flower in her hand and said, Happy Mother's Day. And he said her response surprised him, Though it was garbled, she expressed a very clear mind when she said, "Well, thank you very much. I'm sure it's lovely, but would you mind if I give it to someone else because I can't see it?" So Tom took her wheelchair down the hall to where there are some more alert patients, and as this lady stretched out her hand with a flower in it towards another lady, she said, "Here, this is from Jesus." And he said he realized right then that this was no ordinary human being in this wheelchair. So from that time on, once or twice a week, when he visited that nursing home, he would stop in and visit her. He said, "I found out her name was Mabel. She had grown up single on a farm with her mother. When her mom died, she stayed on, but when she had gone blind, she could not care for herself. She had been confined to a convalescent home. She was now 89 years old. She had been there 25 years and only recently contracted cancer." But Tom Schmidt said, "When I read the Bible to her, she would often quote right along with me, and she would sing songs. I discovered she really loved the Lord. And one day I asked her, I said, 'Mabel, when you're lying here in bed all day, what do you think about?' And she said, 'I just think about Jesus.'" And Tom thought to himself, "I have a hard time doing that for 5 minutes." He said, what do you think about him?" And she said, I just think about how good he's been to me. He's been awfully good to me, you know." She said, "Jesus is all the world to me." And then she started singing, "My life, my joy, my all. He is my strength from day to day. Without him, I would fall. When I am sad, to him I go. No other friend can cheer me so. When I am sad, he makes me glad. He's my friend." And Tom Schmidt wrote, "In the midst of blindness, cancer, pain, and loneliness, Mabel is one of the most effervescent people I have ever met." He said, "That is not a woman denying reality. That is a woman transformed by her relationship with Jesus. A lady who has given herself to God, who has offered her treasure to the one she loves. She loves Jehovah with all her heart and with all her soul and with all her mind. And having done that," Jesus says, "Mabel wins." Interesting and helpful. I don't know. Might have been more interesting if I told you that I found out this week that Bruce Lee had a vegan brother named Brocco. Might have been more interesting if I told you that a country full of Pillsbury Doughboys would be called a donation. Or that incorrectly is the only word that when is spelled right is still spelled incorrectly. Might not have made it more interesting. But whether interesting or not, this sermon could be really, really, really helpful if it helps you realize that we can try to get everything we think we want in life and still be missing it. Or you can choose to build a friendship with God, and you can get to a point where you can say, "Jesus is all the world to me." And then you win. Let's pray.